We've all done it. Stock our fridge with good intentions, only to sacrifice nutrition for convenience. Keep your body and mind nourished with whole body meal shakes from Kachava. It's got 25 grams of protein, 6 grams of fiber, greens, and so much more. But it actually tastes delicious. Try one of Kachava's indulgent flavors today. Shop now through December 2nd to get 30% off your first purchase of 2 or more bags. Go to kachava.com and use code NEWS. That's KACHAVA.com, code NEWS.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
Brought to you by Standard Life. Retirement specialists getting you ready for your second life.
With me this morning is Jack Horgan-Jones, political correspondent with the Irish Times, and Michelle Murphy, research and policy analyst at Social Justice Ireland. And there's been an awful lot of discussion recently about our level of security and whether or not we need to invest more in defence and whether or not we need to invest more in security. And one of the responses is regularly, well, against what? Who would want to do anything to us? The Irish Times has a lead story today suggesting there's evidence of exactly who would want to do something to us. This is your paper, Jack, reporting that the Russians have deliberately been jamming Irish aviation communications and aircraft channels.
Correct. So this is the Conor Gallagher story on the front page of the Irish Times today. And this is something that probably would have, if you'll pardon the pun, come onto people's radar a little bit earlier on this year. Do you remember in September there was this accusation that a plane carrying Ursula von der Leyen, the EU Commission president, was subject to some kind of blocking or jamming, which was thought to originate in Russia? And that kind of put it up in lights for a lot of people that this kind of activity seemed to be going on to a greater or lesser extent. Now, the thing is, it was always presumed to be concentrated in largely in Eastern Europe, potentially an offshoot of tactics to kind of try and interfere with some of the Ukrainian drone force. But this story that Connor has is, I think, a really significant story, not just in an Irish context, but potentially in a European context as well, because of the geography of it. I mean, this seemed, as Connor reports, there have been numerous successful attempts to jam civilian aircraft communications in Irish-controlled airspace in recent years, including at least one incident originating with Russia. And this is based on government records that he's obtained under the Freedom of Information Act, and zooms in on one particular incident in September of 2022, where there was a high-frequency, and I'm going to expose the lack of my technical knowledge here, but there's a high-frequency radio kind of channel which was jammed, and it seemingly affected a large number of civilian aircraft in the Eastern Atlantic, which is a big kind of air traffic control zone that comes under Irish responsibility.
Well, this is a bit like the transatlantic cables. We have a particularly significant role in terms of air traffic control by virtue of the fact that those transatlantic channels, the corridors that you run if you're going from Europe to the States, many of them come through Irish-controlled long-distance airspace.
Correct. It crosses the European threshold in either Irish coastal waters or territorial waters or through Irish-controlled airspace. And I think that the year is interesting as well here. 2022 is obviously the year of the Russian invasion in Ukraine. And we know that part of the kind of Russian modus operandi is to continually probe and test and kind of test the fences of the kind of European security architecture or infrastructure. And, you know, whether we are kind of politically or militarily part of that, I think we are part of it on an operational level. And earlier on this week, I think Connor again was reporting that this now fabled Russian ship, the Antar, was heading around the coast of the UK and down towards Irish territorial waters. So we do seem to be a player in this, for better or worse. And as you teed up in the intro there, that leads to these wider conversations about not only the extent of investment in the Irish military and defence and surveillance capabilities, but also our political stance, our geopolitical stance, are the degree to which we want to be embedded in European security architectures and the degree to which that then interacts with domestic debates around things like the triple lock and neutrality and all the rest of it.
Yeah, because there's almost, Michelle, a sort of a sense that by virtue of neutrality, we are in some way inured to the threats that apply across the rest of Europe. But if you look at the recent, I mean, the most analysts would suggest that the attack on the HSE, the cyber attack, mm-hmm. was state-sponsored or at least state-supported by Russia. We have Russian military exercises in Irish economic waters. We have a Russian spy ship in close to Irish economic waters. We regularly have the RAF interdicting bombers within Irish controlled airspace because we can't do it ourselves. And now we have the discovery that we have communications to civil aviation being jammed. There comes a point where you put all that together and say, we're in it whether we like it or not.
To an extent, yes. And I suppose the you know, the cyber attack on the HSE, it shows that a lot of our IT infrastructure is really outdated, and we do certainly need to invest in that, and certainly even look at the signal jamming element. I suppose we are, as Jack pointed out, on the periphery, on the edge. And I suppose there's also other submarine activity taking place, not just the Russian activity as well, around our waters. I suppose the question is, what are we going to invest in? You would imagine that we should have or would be able to invest in the technology. You know, that the Connor's articles is, you know, that whole frequency was jammed. So then whoever was in that control room had to scramble to get another frequency, let all the pilots know, et cetera, et cetera. Surely we should invest in that kind of technology to sort of prevent that. I imagine most other European countries do. But I suppose to get back to the bigger question of neutrality, like, I doubt Russia is the only country, you know, engaged in this kind of activity. We just happen to be on the edge of the European part of it. I'm sure if you looked in South America or elsewhere, you'd find lots of other states engaged in that kind of activity. And then there's the question of cost. You know, as Jack pointed out, you know, there is a question about investment in defence. The European Commission, like, their first country specific recommendation for every member state was to increase defence spending. But I mean, to go out and have a public discussion here about increasing defence spending when people can't even find somewhere to live, you know, when you can't find school places, you can't get a GP appointment, you're waiting for hours in A&E. I think that would be quite a challenging discussion to have. But I do think one way you could do is just to invest in your IT infrastructure to at least provide a buffer against
the Russian ship
issues.
Drags an anchor across your fiber optic cables and disconnects you from the world's payment system. Investing in your local IT isn't going to make much of a difference.
Well, true, but I mean, that another ship could drag an anchor across your fiber optic cables as well. Sure, because we do have...
Yeah, but it's highly unlikely that a ship accidentally drags its anchor across your fiber optic cables. The only ones who are doing it deliberately, at least according to the Finnish who've had this experience, is the Russians. And
yes. There's
no reason why they wouldn't think it might be nice to do it to us just the way they did it to Finland.
True. And I suppose then the question is, what's our marine capability in terms of that? Like, at the moment, you have a British submarine off the coast monitoring a Russian submarine off the coast to see what that Russian submarine is doing. And apparently it has the capability to launch those drones that we've seen across Europe. And so that's the challenge, that people can't pinpoint where it's from. But the question is in terms of our neutrality, what can we do? What should we do? And, you know, I would imagine that most of our equipment has not seen the capital investment in the past 15 years that it should have.
Is there an element in this that when we think about military attacks, or when we think about threats from other countries, we have a tendency to think in Cold War terms? It's boots on the ground, it's artillery, it's tanks, it's planes, it's all of that. Whereas the reality of the kind of attacks that I assume we are now looking at is hybrid, it's cyber, it's IT, it's drones that you don't know where they come from or who is controlling. It's that kind of thing we need to worry about, not battleships showing up off the coast.
Yeah, or it's just information warfare as well, you know, kind of disinformation, misinformation and all the rest of it. And I think that this is something that the state is going to get a bit of an education in, potentially in the next year or so when we hold the presidency of the EU.
Because, well, there's already reports that we're going to have to borrow ships from France with anti-aircraft capacity.
Yeah, exactly. So it'll be interesting to see to what extent that security effort is resourced from within our own forces, and to what extent there will be kind of, you know, other European militaries or security agencies present in the state and under which auspices they will operate then, you know, because obviously you'll have, I think there's at least one EU summit, but multiple meetings on the road of VIPs, and they bring their own kind of security attachments. So look, it'll be interesting to see how that shakes out. I mean, the whole debate about neutrality is one that we've been having for several years now, and I think that it has its roots really in the fact that certainly the very top of government, the very senior people, I'm talking Taoiseach and Tánaiste, and not just the current incumbents of Taoiseach and Tánaiste, but they seem to be more or less completely convinced that the 2022 invasion fundamentally revised the security balance on the European continent, and that the state needs to react to that. The problem, and that they are in keeping with mainstream European thought on that. The problem is, I think, that the population writ large remains to be convinced of that argument. So you have this kind of tension, and I think that Ireland is probably unique in that, and it's probably unique because of the kind of attachment that people have to neutrality. You know, I think people feel quite deeply about neutrality. I'm not sure the extent to which it's kind of carefully thought about, but there's a deep attachment to it. And partially that's due to, I think, historically, our assertion of neutrality has been linked to our sense of sovereignty, going all the way back to the Second World War, when it was kind of inextricably linked to our separation from Britain, that we would stand alone and separate from this conflict.
But
we
also shouldn't forget. Is there an implicit assumption, though, that nobody wants to interfere with us or do us any harm? Is there a sense that we are somehow special and we don't have to worry about the stuff that the rest of the European member states do?
Well, I mean, to harp on the theme of the Second World War, you know, like, the assumption was that we were vulnerable to invasion then. And that was at a time that we, as I said, neutrality was important for reasons of national identity, you know, are also protecting our kind of strategic or tactical interests as well. But it was also a time when there was massive investment in the defence forces. You know, I think the defence forces were certainly larger then than they have been at any other point in the history of the state. So it's not as if the kind of the importance of neutrality and its centrality in a very real sense can't coexist without what would be probably deemed by almost everyone to be necessary investment in the defence forces, whether that is the acquisition of new capabilities or merely just resourcing the capabilities that we're supposed to have right now. So I think that gets lost sometimes because people kind of muddle up the issue of investment in defence with, you know, the triple lock and or just you know, a shift in our stance on neutrality. It feels to me like we've been having this conversation for a very long time without anything kind of substantially changing. And I just hope that, you know, I hope that we don't come to regret it. I hope that there is not kind of some security kind of mishap or some incident that leads us to go, you know.
If only. Well, that goes to Michelle's point, though. It is, I assume, politically difficult to say we are going to invest huge amounts of money in something nebulous that the public doesn't perceive as a real threat when you have things like people on trolleys.
Yeah, and it is hugely difficult. But I think overall as a state, you know, even if you look at the health system, we still don't have proper electronic patient records. You know what I mean? Which I find incredible at this day and age. So there does need to be substantial investment in, I suppose, our cyber infrastructure, our IT infrastructure, even our security infrastructure. Because I think at the time of the HSE attack, it turned out there was one office with like one or two people who were in charge of our entire cyber security. As Jack mentioned, at the very top of government, I think since 2022, you know, there's certainly been a push in terms of, what's the phrase, we're militarily neutral but not politically neutral. I think that's the phrase that's used. The problem, I think, for the government is they've never taken this discussion to the people. They've had like a forum, they've had, you know, they had a, what was it, 2 years ago, they had their sort of discussion roadshow, but it wasn't really a discussion roadshow. So, you know, people kind of feel they're being talked to. Yes, some of this can be quite nebulous because in terms of your day-to-day life, well, do I want you to put $1 billion in cybersecurity or would I rather I could see a GP or my child could get a school place or occupational therapy or, you know, a needs assessment? I think, you know, it's pretty clear what people would pick. But I don't think politically it's really going to suit them long term to not have sort of an honest discussion about this, because the more it's talked about at the very high level, that it's just assumed that, you know, we're not politically neutral and we should be, you know, engaging with some, in terms of the European Commission, our defence forces. But if you don't actually go and talk to the people about that, then it does become conflated with other things. I suppose the one thing I would say is now is the one time that they do have some money to invest in the capital defence infrastructure, at least. Like, it's one, we do have that money that we should be spending on one-off expenditure. Whether or not they do that, it remains to be seen. But, I mean, then another story in the paper is obviously what's happening in Ukraine at the moment and the 28-point plan that's been presented to them.
Well, let's turn to that. At first glance, Jack, this 28-point plan seems to be 28 different modes of capitulation. Give up all of your stuff and much of your rights to future sovereignty and we'll call that peace.
Yeah, what was the Paul Simon song, 50 Ways to Lose Your Lover? It's 28 Ways to Lose Your Territory. This is splashed in the mail today and they've taken in some copy, presumably from the UK side. And
And they've stuffed Zelensky into a corner. Effectively, this is you lose our support if you don't capitulate these completely unreasonable demands.
He seems to be remarkably and doubly weakened by the fact that he's facing this domestic corruption scandal. I think it relates to the energy sector in Ukraine, and I think it reaches up to people who are quite close to him as well. So he's very much on the defensive there. And it seems that Trump has effectively given him a deadline of Thursday to accept this. And this would, I mean, depending on what angle you look at it from, it's either Trump cozying up to Putin, because it does seem to be almost a kind of wish list from the Kremlin as to how they would like this conflict to end, or it's Trump trying to, you know, be the peacemaker. But we know it's a cold peace often that is left behind the Trump peacemaking efforts. You know, it looks to me like, you know, on the face of it, at best, what you're looking at here is a frozen conflict, not really a resolution, not a kind of lasting peace process, something where the belligerents, one of the belligerents, it's fair to even call them belligerent because they're it's a war of defense for them, but the Ukrainians are ceding huge amounts of territory and staring across at a large military led by a political leadership which has clearly irredentist ambitions over its territory. It doesn't feel like a lasting or indeed a just peace. But
it goes to what we were talking about in terms of defense investment. Europe is Europe capable of stepping into the vacuum if America says we're not doing this anymore?
Well, certainly, like, you have this has become a well-worn pattern at this stage now, where Trump appears to make concessions or to back a Russian perspective on something, and Zelensky appeals to the big European powers. I think he was on to Starmer already, and onto the French as well. So he's kind of trying to rally support from European capitals, who obviously feel they have a direct interest in this because it's on the continental landmass. The extent to which that's going to be successful or not, I don't know. I mean, there is a kind of there's a realpolitik to it, and a very real dimension that I don't know the extent to which European powers can realistically militarily support Kyiv to the extent that they relied certainly on guns and ammo during the Biden years anyway. So can they step into that gap? I'm not sure, but certainly, like,
it's
if you
funny,
look
it's
at
one the, of the things that we tend to, I think a lot of the analysis tends to look at it as if the choice is entirely ideological. But I read an analysis on some of the American support where we're saying the early stages of the war, simply trying to find 150mm shells anywhere in the world to keep the Ukrainians supplied was a massive task. And that it comes down to those simple practicalities of, does Europe have the stuff or the capacity to make the stuff fast enough, even if ideologically and politically they wanted to give the support?
Yeah, and the idea that they could run out of something like 150mm shells is a sobering reminder of just the scale and the brutality and the bloodiness of this conflict. You know, that kind of feels World War One level to me, just lobbing shells at each other across a no man's land almost. But I think that is part of, to return to what we were saying earlier on, it's part of why the von der Leyen Commission has put this huge and controversial effort and focus rather into defence and creating a defence kind of commissioner that wasn't there before, and this whole plan called Rearm Europe, you know, that again there's something vaguely Orwellian about that, like trying to build factories to make bullets and bombs in a way that certainly hasn't been seen, I mean certainly since the Cold War, but you know it does have, as Catherine Connolly said in a slightly different context on the campaign trail, like it has a kind of 1930s feel to it in some ways, like, you know, armed camps emerging on the European continent again, and that's obviously cause for serious and significant concern.
53106, if you want to get in touch, or 087-1400-106. We'll move to matters closer to home. Michelle, Enoch Burke has disappeared. This is follows a criminal contempt warrant being issued for him to be jailed, effectively. Gardaí in, I assume it's somewhere, is it Ballina Garda Station, wherever they might
or
be.
Claremorris, maybe.
I don't know who got the short straw and being told they had to issue or had to serve that warrant, arrived up to the Burke household to see was Enoch there, and he's disappeared.
Yeah, twice apparently, but according to Garrett McNamee in the Daily Mail, the fugitive Enoch
he's
Burke
back.
Has shown up again at his old school to, you know, record a video to let us all know what's happening, which I find it interesting that, you know, the Gardaí couldn't serve the warrant on him after the judge issued that earlier on in the week. He's, for once, he was lying low.
It does strike me that if you don't know where Enoch Burke is and you want to find him, if you wait outside Wilson's Hospital for
long enough
and probably won't be that long, he will turn up.
So yeah, he was there. He filmed a video of himself, you know, obviously decrying Catholic leaders for staying silent, for allowing transgender and pride flags to be hung in Catholic schools. Told his supporters that he's going to be taken away in a prison van for a fourth time. And it's almost like deja vu, really, to be honest. This feels like it's been going on interminably, but it will be interesting to see. I mean, he recorded this, but he's been, you know, a fugitive, for want of a better word, for the past week. So it'll be interesting to see if and when the Gardaí will be able to serve him with that warrant to send him back to prison.
It's also providing great grist to the alt-right mill. Mm. I see James Woods, who starred in Casino as the boyfriend of Sharon Stone and among another of a series of other roles, he's retweeting stories about Enoch Burke, saying that an Irish teacher is being pursued by the police and the courts because of his views on transgenderism, which is quite the stretch.
Well, I mean, it's factually incorrect.
That's a better way to put it.
he's been in prison for contempt of court. There's nothing to do with his views or anything like that. But you're right. It's he's become a cause celeb because the case can be easily and misleadingly truncated and presented like that. And I think, I mean, doesn't Elon Musk tweet about him?
Yep,
on a fairly regular basis.
And we've had Joe Rogan discussing him as well. All of whom tend to ignore, as you point out, the contempt of court and the breaching of court orders and the harassing of the principal, and focus solely on the original Genesis issue that annoyed him enough to start harassing the principal.
Because these are the kind of stories that move at light speed through that particular part of the internet, you know, and that particular part of the internet, and those who are expert at exploiting it, they don't give a fiddler's for, you know, what's accurate.
So what do you do if you're the court system? Because the court system is now running out of stuff to try. They've done the fines, they've done the jailing, they've done the not jailing, they've done the asking nicely, they've done the jailing again, and none of it seems to be having any effect on anything.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Like, I suppose, what do you do if you're confronted by a politics that, you know, effectively seeks to not play by your rules and thrives off confrontation with the system or with the establishment? And not only, like, most people would like to kind of avoid being sent to jail and embroiled in a long running court battle where your liberty is at stake, not to mention your wealth. But this is a brand of politics that seeks that confrontation. And you know, it's not just confined to the Burkes. You see it in migration politics as well, to a large extent, you know, where activists in that space seek a kind of asymmetric kind of conflict. You know, they've been serially unsuccessful in getting themselves elected at any meaningful scale so far. But, you know, this is something I'll be looking at, I think, quite closely in the Dublin Central by-election, where I don't think the successful candidate will come from that space, but I think that it will, that particular race will be targeted because it'll be high profile. It's a geographic part of the city where actually was the ground zero for anti-IPAS centre protests, and that's the kind of type of political moment that we live in where people seek out this kind of stuff.
It's very interesting though to see the High Court become exasperated. Yeah. I mean, the judge's verdict the other day, if you read it, he says in the middle of it that Enoch Burke said to him, "Wipe that smile off your face." And I'm paraphrasing, but the judge effectively says, you can't say that to a High Court judge.
Well, you know what I think it shows? It's like most people, if you're in front of a judge, if you're in court for any reason, you know, you have the shirt and tie on, you are mute at most times.
Or you abuse the judge.
But it's the fact that, you know, this person and this family feel that they have the right to, you know, abuse a High Court judge and abuse the High Court system. But I do think it does show the flaws, some flaws in our legal system when it comes to this kind of contempt, because there, you know, what other avenue is open to the court now apart from sending him back to prison again? And clearly he's decided he doesn't want to go back for a fourth time, or he would have let that notice been served. Probably doesn't want to be in there for Christmas. You know, he's been in there 523 days, I think he read. He's probably had enough. But the question is then, what do you do? And what does the school do? Because is he just, you know, they hired security guards. He was being driven in by different cars every day, you know, filming his videos. Like, where does it end, really, is the question.
And particularly for the teachers, staff, parents and students in that school. This has gone, I would imagine, long past a joke. Guys, thank you very much. Michelle Murphy, Research and Policy Analyst at Social Justice Ireland, and Jack Horgan-Jones, political correspondent with the Irish Times.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
We've all done it. Stock our fridge with good intentions, only to sacrifice nutrition for convenience. Keep your body and mind nourished with whole body meal shakes from Kachava. It's got 25 grams of protein, 6 grams of fiber, greens, and so much more. But it actually tastes delicious. Try one of Kachava's indulgent flavors today. Shop now through December 2nd to get 30% off your first purchase of 2 or more bags. Go to kachava.com and use code NEWS. That's KACHAVA.com, code NEWS.